Insurance Committee on insurance issues. This is our third day, and present are Representative Barnes, Representative Barr, Representative Ulmer, and myself, Representative Sund, and Representative Gruenberg was here. And we have a quorum. Chairman Donnelly.
We'll call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Present are Representatives Furness, Davidson, Kopanen, and myself.
Okay, in the last 2 days, we've covered a general overview of insurance, and yesterday we spent some time on malpractice and health insurance. Today is the intention to go through some workman's comp issues, marine and aviation insurance. And those who have been participating with this, we have had some testimony and some time for questions, and it has been somewhat controlled. So I'd like to get the committee members to, if they have some questions, to try to remember that other committee members may have questions too, to try to limit your question to one question at a time, Representative Barr, so that other people may have a chance to ask some questions and proceed on it. So with that, we'd like to start workman's comp on the benefit issue. Jackie McClintock. Jackie here. And then we have Director of Insurance John George on the rate structure, and Frank Mears from the small business perspective and the Workman's Comp Committee of Alaska to give us a little perspective there. So we'll try to get through that in the first 45 minutes here. So, Jackie, please tell us why we're having a 14% rate increase.
Okay.
I'd like to note for the record, Representative Gruenberg and Representative Menard and Representative Taylor are with us.
Well, I think the director of the Division of Insurance is probably going to be more apt to tell you why rates are going up. My talk to you today, I think, is going to center on the types of benefits that come under the Workers' Compensation Act.
Proceed.
I guess I better introduce myself. My name is Jackie McClintock, director of the Workers' Compensation Division. To quickly review the benefit structure, I made a copy of this booklet, I think, that you might all have, and we'll quickly race through the different types of benefits. The publication is put out by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the analysis of workers' compensation law. It gives a very brief comparison of the laws of the 50 states, the territories, the Canadian provinces, and the federal jurisdictions. What this particular publication covers is the coverage of laws for the various jurisdictions, the benefits provided, and the different methods by which the laws are administered under each jurisdiction. Did you get that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And of course, what we'll be basically centering in on is the benefit provisions. It's important to keep in mind when reviewing this analysis that the entire scope of any workers' comp system of any jurisdiction has to operate as a whole. So you can't take just one particular issue out or one particular kind of benefit out and say, okay, one state is paying too much on this benefit or is paying too low on another benefit, because it's a combination of all benefit schemes that make the operation work. It all depends basically on what emphasis the particular jurisdiction has put on the different benefit schedules. This publication, and Mr. Chairman, I didn't make a copy of this because it's kind of voluminous, but I will leave it in front of the chairs, and if you want to review it at a later time, you can. By the way, in this booklet, the legislative changes that were enacted in 1986 are not yet published in the publication. If you would turn to page 3 of the publication first. Page number's on your lower right-hand side, and it's chart 1, and this covers the type of law and the insurance requirements. Again, John George will probably be going through that a little bit more, but just quickly, I wanted to say that Alaska's law is compulsory, is required through private insurance, with self-insurance permitted by approval of the board. The charts 3 through 4 go into more detail on the coverage of laws, and I won't go further into that at this point, except to point out that Alaska law covers all injuries, illnesses, and diseases arising out of and in the course of employment. The benefits section is part 2, and I'd like you to turn first to page 24, chart 9, which covers the waiting period for income benefits and medical benefits. Have I lost anything yet? Okay. As to medical benefits, Alaska, with all jurisdictions except one, has unlimited medical benefits. Alaska's law includes damages to eyeglasses, dentures, hearing aids, or any prosthetic devices. And the choice of physician in Alaska, as with the majority of the jurisdictions, is by employee choice. Actually, the majority of our injuries are what we would term medical-only claims, like 20,000 out of the 30,000 injuries that are logged each year with our physician. The person is hurt, goes to a doctor, and that's the end of it. However, for those cases that involve missed time from work, term time loss cases, the injured worker does not draw disability benefits until after 3 days off work. If he is disabled more than 28 days, the first three are paid and continue as temporary total disability. Now if you go back to page 17, and this deals with the payment of temporary total disability benefits. Temporary total disability benefits in Alaska are based, and this is under the law that became effective January 1st, 1984, on 80% of the injured worker's spendable or take-home pay. You arrive at this calculation by taking the previous 2 years of employment, on the injured worker, not including the year of injury, and dividing by 100 weeks. That then becomes the worker's gross weekly earnings. From that, his tax liability is computed from tables that we distribute. His net or spendable earnings are arrived at, and he is paid at 80% of that figure. Prior to January 1, 1984, and actually there have been a lot of changes before that time, but the immediately prior law allowed for the injured worker to select the best year's earnings out of his previous 3 years, not including the year of injury, divided by 52, and then taking that times 66 2/3% of his gross earnings. So instead of gross earnings now, we work with net earnings to take into consideration the tax load.
Mr. Chairman, could I just have one quick question here? Mrs. President, I noticed just a brief scan. Alaska appears to have the highest weekly maximum payment. That's just maximum weekly payment up top there. Of $1,114, and it's totally skewed. It looks like the other state closest to that would probably be in the neighborhood of around $600. Why is that such a disparity there?
Okay, and I go into that a little bit later, and I'll probably
repeat. Don't answer that.
Okay, all right, okay. I will just get to that in just a bit. The average weekly wage provision in Alaska is different than most jurisdictions using the wage at time of injury, simply because of the very seasonal type of work that Alaska has. We did have wage at injury at one time, but that was repealed in 1977. The best out of the past 3 years provision was changed in 1984 to what we have to average out the highs, say, of a pipeline economy and the lows of an economic depression as we have now. Actually, those methods cut both ways, no matter how they're figured. It depends solely on the history of the injured worker and whether it's going to be to his advantage or not to his advantage of however the wages are computed. The 80% of net spendable change was supposed to even out, again, the high wage earner's liability for tax benefits by taking his tax deductions into consideration. Instead, of course, on the workers' comp benefits, there's no taxes paid. For the low wage earner, 80% actually increased benefits a little bit. For the high wage earner, of course, they decreased them. Alaska's maximum total disability, which means you are totally disabled from working either temporarily or permanently, the rate is based on 200% of the state's average weekly wage. This year, the average weekly wage is $554, so the maximum comp rate is $1,108 instead of the $1,114 figure. Now that sounds like a lot, but in actual practice, there are very few injured workers who draw anything close to that, particularly in today's employment market. For example, if you claim married to, you would have to earn over $115,000 per year to earn that maximum amount. If you were single one, claiming single one, the figure would be about $120,000 per year that you'd have to earn.
He's got to work for the university.
Although we haven't done a run on this for some time, the last run that we made showed an average comp rate of about $400 to $500. On total disability benefits, an offset for Social Security can be taken by the employer if the worker is drawing that Social Security benefit. In those states who do not take the Social Security benefit in compensation, the offset is taken by Social Security, so the combination of workers' comp and Social Security, in some way or another, that benefit is reduced if the worker is drawing both benefits. Temporary total disability benefits are paid during the healing period. While you cannot work, until you're able to return to suitable gainful employment if you're disabled from returning to your regular type of work. If you are never able to return to productive employment, then those benefits continue at the same rate as permanent total disability. If you go to page 20, I'm still getting to that question. This is permanent partial disability or scheduled injuries, meaning injuries to the arms, legs, hands, feet, whatever the appendages, versus the unscheduled injuries, say, to the back or neck. The purpose of permanent partial disability benefits is to recompense an injured worker for the financial loss of a disability that is partial in character but permanent in quality. Again, it is computed at 80% of the worker's spendable weekly wage, and as with most states, is paid in addition to temporary benefits. As with most states, Alaska opted for a schedule to pay these types of permanent injuries more for administrative ease and lack of litigation. Well, that's probably not really held true. But there is less litigation on this particular type of benefit than with unscheduled permanent partial disability, where you have to figure the person's future loss of earning capacity. The way it works for scheduled permanent partial disability, the worker gets a permanent impairment rating from his treating physician according to the AMA guides to the evaluation of permanent impairment. That percentage rating is then multiplied by the number of maximum weeks allowed for the scheduled permanent injury, and the result multiplied by the worker's compensation rate up to a maximum dollar amount of whatever is allowed for that injury. If you look at your chart, those figures that you see are the maximum dollar amounts that are allowed for each injury type. For instance, yes.
I'm curious. I assume FECA is Federal Employment Compensation Act.
That is correct.
Can you explain to me why in the world the federal government is as much as 10 times higher?
It's 5 times, actually. Yeah.
And Wyoming's sitting there at $35,000 and the federal government's sitting at $305,000 for the loss of an arm and shoulder from the District of Columbia. I mean, it's not quite as bad. It was $137,000 or something. Decent.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is probably the good time to answer both of the questions by Representative Furness and Representative Taylor. And that is, I go back to again, it depends on what emphasis the jurisdiction has put on the benefit. Again, that's why you can't take this benefit or this benefit and say that's too high or too low. You have to take the complete benefit structure. FECA or long-term harbor worker, which our act is based on, pays much higher in permanent partial disabilities, both scheduled and unscheduled, but pays much higher than Alaska, even though Alaska has, as Representative Furness said, the highest temporary total disability rate in the nation. I don't know if that makes sense. It's just that a different emphasis at some time or another was put on the payment of maybe temporary total disability benefits instead of the permanent disability benefits. If you do a long-range study and find out what comes out best, I don't know exactly where it would take you, but I think if you take the system as a whole, then you'll find that Alaska does pay as well as any other state. Individually, it may pay less or more in different benefit types. I can't tell you why one was done and not the other.
I mean, looking all the way across on every benefit for FECA, if you're going to have any permanent injury, you better have it while you're working for the federal government. Because it's a lot more money than any state. It's incredible.
Alabama looks almost as good as Alaska.
Yeah, Alabama's about as good as it.
And I think that's the problem with any schedule, is that it very often overpays. Maybe for a person like me that has a 10% rating of the arm, which wouldn't really affect my, or even the total loss of my arm, wouldn't affect my wage earning capacity. But for a laborer or for an electrician, it would very much affect his wage earning capacity or his livelihood.
Dennis?
I made more money after I lost my arm than in the left hand, and that argument doesn't hold.
Is that right? Maybe I can do something else.
I tried everything not to go back to work. I had to go back to work. There was nothing available.
But now you're paying the system because you benefited. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
I think that kind of problem is inherent in every state that I'm aware of that uses a schedule. The trade-off in increased litigation and promptness of payments may or may not be worth it. I guess that's the thing. Also, it has to be studied and compared with other jurisdictions. A chart is not provided in this particular book, although, again, it's outlined a little bit better in this book, for unscheduled injuries, probably because of the complexity of that issue and the very numerous ways that each jurisdiction computes it. In Alaska, it is paid, again, at 80% of net spendable, of the difference between the worker's wages prior to the entry and his wage earning capacity, which is sometimes a tough number to get to, after that entry. Those benefits are paid during the continuance of the disability. There are no maximum weeks, but they are paid in our state up to a maximum of $60,000. Now, again, the others, states aren't listed here, but I think I noticed that in this other book, there were 31 state and federal jurisdictions that pay a higher maximum than Alaska, and 14 that have no maximum permanent partial disability or unscheduled permanent partial disability at all. So again, it's just hard to draw a meaningful comparison until you take the system and the benefit structure as a whole. If you would go to page, let me cover one more area. Temporary partial disability benefits were also not listed in this book. In Alaska, it pays for the temporary decrease in earning capacity, computed again at 80% prior and after wages. Probably the best example of that is somebody that is can't go back to the regular type of work, is gone for retraining, but has to go into a apprenticeship program for a while, or 2 years or whatever. That person would get temporary partial disability until the apprenticeship program was over, and until his wages had more or less evened out or stabilized. If you go to page 22, okay. Page 22, chart 8, deals with death benefits. Benefits payable to the spouse and children are, again, based on 80% of the deceased's spendable earnings, payable to the child until 19 or out of school, unless disabled or wholly dependent, and to the spouse for life or until remarriage. Upon remarriage, the spouse will get a lump sum payment of 2 years of benefits. However, Alaska has a bit different provision than what I'm able to see in any other state, and that is that the spouse's benefit is reduced by one-third at 5 years after the worker's death, is reduced by one-half at 8 years after the worker's death, and benefits cease at 10 years unless that spouse has reached age 52 at any time during that process or during the time of the 10 years.
We didn't want to discourage remarriage.
That's probably right. The Social Security offset also applies to these benefits. Finally, on page 26, chart 10, rehabilitation benefits, this new law,
before you go on, I note that it says maximum burial of $2,500 in Alaska.
That changed in 19, I got my book over there, I think that was increased in 1984, I believe, but I'll have to check. It was less than that. It was 2,000 before that was a thousand.
Right. It was 1,000, I thought. I'm not sure. The other question I had is you don't indicate any payment to the second injury fund here, which my understanding is a $10,000 payment goes to that.
Only if the deceased leaves no dependents. If there's no dependents, then there is a $10,000 lump sum payment that is paid to the second injury.
Would you explain that second injury fund to us, please?
Sure.
I don't see how it relates to any of this. Or
there is a back of the administration section, and I probably won't get to that portion. It does explain the second injury fund and how they're funded. There are all different ways throughout the jurisdictions. What's it used for? The second injury fund now is used, it's always been this way, but to reimburse employers if they have hired a disabled person, and that disabled person, under certain conditions, gets re-injured, and his disability is worse, then the second injury fund will pick up disability after the first 104 weeks of compensation. It's basically established to encourage employers to hire previously impaired persons, and that doesn't mean by injuries for any reason.
It was to encourage them to do so.
That's right.
I think, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I know we're in a hurry to go through this, but this is an important point, at least to me, and I think the committee needs to be made aware of it, that under our current workman's compensation law, a single person, a young male or female, 20s, let's say, or 30s even, with no children, not sending any money home to parents or other parties so that there are, quote, no qualified dependents of that person, that's killed while working on a job in Alaska, they get up to a maximum of $2,500 paid for their burial expenses. The insurance carrier then funds a second injury trust program to encourage that employer or others to hire people who have been previously injured. Absolutely nothing goes to the estate. They're totally denied any recovery whatsoever. That's the way our current law presently exists. I don't think most people are aware of that. But if that person leaves a spouse and child, you're looking at over $1 million. Depending on where they're at. Right?
Yeah, but I guess you know, the idea of workers' comp, of course, is to pay dependents for that worker's loss of his earnings. And I don't know exactly how it would. I don't have an objection to it, but I don't know how it would exactly work when you don't have anybody that's dependent on that.
If I could interject, the insurance companies like to argue that in wrongful death cases too, that since there isn't any survivors in this case that Representative Taylor's laid out, why should we pay anything? But they do have to pay to the person's estate. There's always, at least the state would collect if nobody else is there. But
well, even under Alaska law, in answer to your question,
no,
the child
costs,
has the obligation to support the parent, and the parent has the obligation to support the child when that person needs that form of support. So assuming that you've got the 63-year-old mother and the 41-year-old son, and we kill the 41-year-old son, though he hasn't been sending anything home to her because she's getting by, maybe by the time she's 75, she's not getting by when he would be at his prime earning capacity and would definitely be taking care of his mother. But she doesn't today qualify. Basically, what I'm telling you is that it's a grievous, in my opinion, denial of equal protection under the laws to have our Alaska workman's comp statute set up so that the person who happens to be living with a girlfriend and paying the rent on her place and has an illegitimate child by her, she and that child are going to pick up the full benefits. That may be well over $1 million. The rest of his estate is zip. And we aren't even, if you blow him up in little bits like the client I had, you don't even have to pay for the burial. So they walk away clean. And then you reward the employer by encouraging that employer who negligently killed the employee to go out and hire somebody that's injured, and we'll help you with his wages out of the money that came from this guy getting blown up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, at that point, couldn't they sue for wrongful death if there was a negligence on the part of the employer?
No.
No, there's no.
That's a workman's comp.
That's not. That's workman's comp.
The employer sued the insurer stuff, yeah. $10,000 for second injury.
Again, running.
Again,
running the tight ship that we have to run. We got to move on here if we're going to get through this.
Very quickly, rehabilitation benefits. If a worker is unable to return to gainful employment or to his regular employment. Rehabilitation benefits are provided for a period of 37 weeks, extendable up to 74 weeks. The employer pays all costs of rehabilitation, including temporary total disability during the rehabilitation period. Benefits can be suspended for any time that a injured worker refuses to cooperate with rehabilitation. The rest of the section, as I said before, deals with administration. Second injury fund is listed there. If you have any kind of questions, I would be happy to respond to them.
Okay, Jackie, thank you very much, and I appreciate your overview, and I know we're going to get into this after we get into the other people testifying why the rates are going up and why they shouldn't. You will be a regular at one of these committee meetings, so.
Thank you.
John George, we're running a little bit into time, John. We've got you for 15 minutes. If you could tell us why we're having such a rate increase in 5 and why you're going to roll it back, we'll be in good shape.
I'll do even better than that. I will give you about 2 minutes, and then I will refer to Mr. Koch, who is my workman's comp expert. You always refer to an expert instead of a generalist. In this case, I'm going to do that. But let me say that this year, when the rate increase was filed, we felt because of the downturn in the economy, because of the size of the rate increase and being sensitive to that, that we decided that, unlike our normal procedure on rate filings, that we would call a public hearing, that we would require the rating bureau, in this case the NCCI, National Council of Compensation Insurance, to send a person to explain the rating methods and explain the ins and outs of this rate filing for the public that would be burdened with the payment. As a result of that hearing, we have issued an order 86-3, which I think each of you have in your packet. We went to great lengths to explain in this order the reasons, the justification, the methodology that goes into the rate filing. And I would encourage each of you to spend a few minutes, as long as it takes, to go through that to understand generically how that rate was determined, arrived at,
And I think it will give you a much better understanding from which to ask questions and whatever. As far as the actual rate increase, if, with permission of the chairs, I would like Don Koch to come up and take my place and give you a more specific explanation. And I think he's much better prepared to answer questions on specific workman's comp issues.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Thank you. My name is Don Koch. I'm Special Deputy with the Division of Insurance. And it was my responsibility to review the rate filing that led to the hearing, that led to the order that you have in front of you. This incidentally is the rate filing, so that's one idea. This thing has got a world of data in it, and there are, just to give you a short aside, I would say that approximately two-thirds of it deals with about 0.5% of the indications. So, frankly, with the filing of this size, we set that two-thirds aside and allow for the 0.5% that that represented, which left us with the remaining 14 or thereabouts. That left something a little bit less to contend with. We prioritized the contents of the filing and went from there. Every year, along about May, I do a review based on the data that we gather independent of the rating organization that puts this together for the insurance companies. Last year, when I put together that analysis, basically what we do this for is to get some idea of where the rates are heading for next year, so we have some idea of what we're going to be facing. When I put the analysis together last year, it was my opinion that we were looking towards something on the order of a 25% rate increase for the coming year. Generally, over the past 10, 12 years that I've been doing this sort of thing, I come within about 2 or 3% of the ultimate indication.
Pardon me, this is the Anchorage Bridge and all the sites of lost transmission from Juneau.
I got the switch on the right place?
Yeah, just push turn it up. Push it forward. Just keep going.
It is up.
Done.
Sorry about that. At any rate, when I have done this in the past, I've come within 2 or 3%, and so I was more than a little disturbed this past year when I found we were looking at a potential 25, so I went back to the drawing board to see what might be causing some of this. There were some reserve changes, and we accounted for those. There were some anomalies in reporting, and so we discounted those. Where insurance companies had results that were really way off base, we examined those to see what's going on. We went into annual statements to look at what the individual companies were reporting, what their finances looked like, what the development for this line of insurance looked like. And we have a world of stuff to look at. And we were still coming out in this range of 20-25%. The insurance companies in late summer started making motions that they were facing rather substantial increases. And I said, oh, well, here it comes, expecting a 25. In fact, when they did make their filing, they did discount the results that they had. But they discounted to the tune of about 5%. And the reason for so doing, as they explained it, was that they felt there may be some ripples in the numbers. But nevertheless, they were still coming in substantially below where we were. I'm still convinced that the filing that was made this time is probably on the order of 5-10% deficient. That's not a very nice picture, and frankly, we're going to have a better feel for what's going to happen with this along about May when we have a chance to look at another year's worth of the numbers.
Just a minute, Don. What you're saying is that, if I understand it right, this 14% increase in your mind should have been 20?
20-25, yes, sir. I think this...
We're going the wrong direction.
Pardon?
I said we're going the wrong way.
I can only speak for the numbers that we've got, and we've done an awful lot of work to make sure that those numbers are right. And we've looked at developments, which means we've looked at how those numbers shape up year after year to see that we're not getting some funny gains in there. But in my opinion, this filing is still deficient. Now, obviously, sitting in a public hearing, it is not necessarily all well for the public to say, no, we're going to refuse this filing because we think you should be giving us 25. And in fact, I was prepared to take the 14 as it was, on the idea that maybe some of the things I was looking at had ripples in it, and that the rating bureau was right, and the ripples are not, maybe they should be greater. But at any rate, that's kind of a starting date for this. We do have a lot of specific class data, in other words, information by classification. And as you might expect, we've had quite a few phone calls and bits of correspondence dealing with particular rate increases for individual classifications. We had, just for example, a person who works with sheet metal come to us a little bit ago, and he was very much offended by the fact that his rates went up 46%. And so he felt that perhaps high-rise steel and Butler buildings and that sort of thing were being included in his rate, until we pointed out that the Butler building rates were up to $83, whereas he was at 20. And so their experience was definitely not in there. High-rise steel is in the mid-40s, and so their experience is not in there in this class, at least to the degree that we could see it wasn't. And we have tried to respond to people that have come to us with specific requests to look at the data on the class, and it's in there, plus what we have in the office. I can answer more questions on this, but I think, as John indicated, that if you take a look through that order, what we tried to do is set the stage, if you will, to explain what we saw as our responsibilities, what we see as our role in this whole process, and I think that sets a pretty good stage for any questions that you might have of us within the context of what we feel we can answer. If there are things outside of that that we really have no control over. We have no control over the benefits, and that's kind of in your shop. We do have control over what the insurers do, and to that degree, for that, we try to work cooperatively with the Division of Workers' Comp. They flag us on anything that they view as a potential unfair practice, and we've got those things compiled so that when we see that there does appear to be a trend, we can go to the insurance company and say, hey, you're doing something that doesn't look best to be right, let's get it fixed. Or if we have resistance, we're quite prepared to go to the wall with it. When I get to Anchorage or wherever else to visit with these insurance companies, I usually have a mitt full of those things so that I can take those issues up and say, something's going bonkers, what's happening here, let's fix this. I can answer questions, like I say, on that file, and I don't prefer to do so. I understand one of the other issues that you were interested in is some changes in recently in the assigned risk plan. The assigned risk plan is a portion of the workers' comp market that is involuntary. Every insurer that writes coverage in the state must participate in this assigned risk plan. That assigned risk plan is basically subsidized by the voluntary plan, those who place their insurance coverages voluntarily. However, there is a 20% surcharge on the assigned risk plan. It just recently went up from 10, which caused a bit more of a fear, I believe. However, in our view, and in looking at the numbers that we can get from the National Council, the surcharge ought to be about 33% to remove the subsidy. Unfortunately, there's an awful lot of folks that end up in that plan that end up there purely because they're small. The small risk that maybe has $2,000 or $3,000 of payroll a year, that's where they end up, because most insurers don't want to look at a real small workers' comp risk. It's just difficult for them to deal with. So what we have said to them is, those people for the most part are paying a minimum premium. And in the past, the minimum premium has been surcharged, 20%, depending on the level of surcharging for that. The insurance companies, upon our having pointed it out, have agreed that the application of that surcharge to the minimum premium is inappropriate. So minimum premiums are no longer surcharged. The actual premium, developed premium, is. If that actual developed premium is under the minimum, then they will have the minimum premium, but no longer do we have a surcharge to the minimum premium. Am I making sense on that? No.
Yeah, but don't people also, not because they're just small, get put in that assigned risk just because they're new? You have to have 3 years of work history, regardless of the history within an industry?
Well, that's to a large extent true. Primarily what an insurer looks at when they're underwriting workers' comp risk is what's their track record. And the argument is they want to see some experience in the track record before they do it. 3 years is an arbitrary number, and I'm sure there are those who will write, people who are brain stinking new, there will be those who will write them at 1, 2, some who won't write even after 3. So that's a very, in other words, that's, I haven't detected that that's a set number, but yes, typically insurers will not accept business voluntarily unless it's got something of a track record in that.
So when you look at our small businesses, trying to, guy going out trying to create a small business, he gets hit with this. One, because he's a new business. Secondly, because he's small. So it's almost an autopilot thing. You get shoved into a 20% surcharge.
Yes, sir.
And that's something that the insurance company does.
This is also very much in our minds when we determined that we were not about to go beyond the 20% surcharge. 20% was a jump up from 10, but it's far cry from 33. And when the insurers were starting to talk in terms of increasing that, we made it pretty clear we would not want to go beyond 20. In other words, there still exists and will continue to exist, we believe, a subsidy. But we're just not prepared to remove all of it. That's kind of a balancing act.
Okay, any questions of Don? Representative Taylor?
How much of this rate is being driven by insurers and excess carriers?
The excess, I suspect you're referring to reinsurance.
That's what I meant, Don, yes.
And I would say very little of it, because what we look at when we're looking at the rates is we look at gross loss. And whether the insurer bears it directly or the reinsurer bears it, we don't look upon that as being something passed on to the insurer. There's another factor at work in this one. This is an approximately $160 million line of business in the state. So it's probably our largest, certainly our largest property casualty line of business. There's no other line that comes close to that. So to a large degree, we've got a fair amount of credibility for quite a few plans. We can pretty much live on what numbers we're seeing coming off of this. That is not to say that there are not insurers out there who, because of their size, have difficulty picking up insurance at realistic rates. But it seems like what has happened is where reinsurance rates have gotten out of whack, those risks that would normally be falling into those kinds of things have found themselves in the pool. Those then are reinsured by all insurers, and that's not the subject of a real rate problem. That would be So we have not detected, at least in workers' comp, we have not detected that the reinsurance area has caused any undue impact on the rate structure. We don't believe, from what we've seen, that reinsurance has any effect on workers' comp rates as a simple component.
I'm only familiar with Donald Peterson. The small reciprocal down in my area.
Yes, the timber exchange.
And the Tongass Timber Exchange, and I'm ballparking these figures, but 2 years ago, they were at $300,000 for their reinsurance. The year before that, they were at $100,000+ for reinsurance. And this last year, they were at $1.2 million for the same reinsurance. That, together with the requirement by their reinsurer that they increase reserves significantly, drove their premium up almost by twice.
We have a slightly different problem with that particular company. It's not exactly a problem. First off, remember that it is a reciprocal exchange. So to the degree that there are surplus monies coming out of those reserves, or the surplus monies that have been set aside for losses, the policyholders are the owners of that reciprocal, and they get it back. The trouble is, of course, that the reciprocal exchange will have the use of those monies for a period of time, but they do get it back. The next problem was that their reinsurer basically told them that they could not deviate from the National Council's rate by more than 10%. And in effect, that was forcing their rates to climb unduly. We supplied them and the reinsurer with some information that resulted, or that came out of an examination we did a few years back, to say why the reciprocal, that particular exchange, why that particular exchange's rates were so different than the manual rates. They have some other things that work for them. When you have one company that has such a concentration of one class of business, the development changes, and there's a lot of other things that are not really Clinton's averages. And so we pointed those out to the reinsurer. I understand from the discussions I've had with those folks that they're having a little easier time with that. You know, it's not to say that it's fixed, but that reinsurance rate is not affecting the manual rate. It is affecting the amount of money they had to put up front initially. But we see it as they're going to get that back, or a good chunk of it back.
They don't get back the amount they paid the reinsurer. Well, that $1.2 million last year is now gone money.
That is true.
They don't get any of it back.
That is true.
The only thing you're talking about them getting back is to the extent that they increase their capital investment within the company. If those funds aren't used after a given period of years, they will get some of those funds back.
They will get their excess loss funds back to the degree that they don't use that for enhancing the capitalization of the company. Yes.
Right.
Okay. Yes. So it's not a perfect answer, but by the same token, that reinsurance hasn't driven the manual rate, which is where they start working on, hasn't driven that. It is going to affect what a reciprocal will get back, but it doesn't really affect the manual rate, at least it hasn't at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Don. I'll just close on that. I think that from the Tongass Timber Trust, what the experience is that workman's comp insurance in the timber business, one of the highest risk businesses we have. And these guys, loggers, went out and formed their own reciprocal, lowered their premium rates for workman's comp by about 50% or 60% under what they were paying, paid it for many years, merged with INA, I believe it was. After about 4 or 5 years, INA had run the rate back up to what it was before. These guys got a little upset with that, went out, formed their own reciprocal again, cut their workman's comp rate in half. And that's where they're at now. And I guess that's why Representative Taylor and I get so darn upset with some of these workman's comp rates. We think we're getting ripped off because these guys that can put reciprocals together can do it for about 50% what everybody else is paying.
They can do that when you have particular circumstances like that particular exchange, because they are pretty much a homogeneous group. They're pretty much regionalized. And you've got one insurer that's got it all.
And plus they have a good safety record amongst themselves, and they kick out the bad actors.
Most importantly, it's tied to an excellent safety program, a good communications net, and a number of other things. So it's a nice shining example, and every time we have the opportunity, we try to point to that. That's the way we'd like to see it.
Thanks, Don.
Let me have one brief follow-up on that. Even so, Don, they presently are having difficulties with major insurers who are charging other people in the state the full bore. Coming in, trying to vacuum off their two or three biggest employers within that group by offering even lower rates now than they can offer to try and pull them out of that pool and thus destroy it. So I know what they're doing there.
We know that we're aware of that. The Timber Exchange has told us about that, and we're trying to monitor it to the degree we can. We know some ways to fix that.
Maybe one way to fix it is that they can come in for the loggers at that lower price. Maybe every other manufacturer in the state ought to be told by you that if they can offer it to them, they can offer it to everybody else up here at that price, too. Mm-hmm.
We have a cure for that. I can discuss with
you.
Okay. we're running a little bit behind. We have a person in this blue binder in front of you. And in the view of the time, Frank, and I know you have some issues to say, if you could summarize your testimony rather than read it, and carry through with that, I would appreciate it and open some questions up. Didn't everybody get one? I guess just the, okay, it's not in a blue binder, it's typewritten, there you go. It should be available to you. But if you could just take it through it, summarize it through it, Frank, otherwise I'm not going to get through everybody. Sorry for giving you a little short time.
What I've written down here will be adequate. Again, my name is Frank Thomas Mears. I'm the acting chairman of the Workers' Comp Committee of Alaska. I'm also one of the founding directors of the Alaska Subcontractors Association. I'm also chairman of the Alaska Association of Small Business. Is management mad? Yes, sir. Is labor mad? Yes, sir. Management and labor have said, we're both fed up, we're both mad, we're both going to sit down, roll up our sleeves, and take a look. There is something wrong in the Alaska workers' comp system. There are many things wrong. I don't think that today is the time nor the place to go into details of what is wrong, but I will tell you that management and labor agree on a whole lot of points. The assigned risk plan. Let's talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about the fact that 2 years ago, the same companies that were offering up to 85% discounts are now saying to new business, any business, I mean, there was a wide range of discounts offered. Suddenly, a year or two later, they're saying, sorry, if you haven't been in business X number of years, if you're not a big guy, if you haven't got a tall enough minimum premium, you go to the pool. Is there some swapping going on to get people into the pool? Yes, sir. I'm going to submit that there is. My background is as an insurance broker. I'm no longer a broker. I'm out on my own, and I'm doing something entirely different in the realm of self-insurance. However, I do have a lot of contacts throughout the brokerage community. Are there games being played? Are companies trading off and saying, wait, don't send us the business. Wait until you go around a few places and it has to come to us through the pool. Yes, that is happening. There's a lot going on out there that I, for one, don't happen to agree with. Second injury fund. That was an interesting question. How many employers, how many of the people in this room that are employers, and I don't expect an answer, even realize that number one, there is a second injury fund. Number two, how many realize that in order to even utilize that fund, you have to have a complete medical exam of an employee before they come on board. You have to have documented proof that they were previously injured or disabled from a work comp related type injury. The second injury fund doesn't do much. There are very few people, employees or employers, that receive any of the benefits of that second injury fund. I believe right now there's an excess of several million dollars sitting in there. Now that means that employers don't have to pay into it for a while, but we're still paying in, and there aren't many people using it. The way it's structured and set up now, it is not a benefit. It is not an encouragement to management, because they don't know it's there. Then when you have it, even if you bring one of these people in, you do everything, you dot all the I's, you cross all the T's, you still have the fact that for the first 104 weeks after they're injured, it's still coming out of your pocket. That's not an encouragement. I will congratulate the Division of Insurance, Division of Work Comp, both, for being very open and helpful in this whole thing. When the Division of Insurance held their hearings back in November, there was absolutely no reason, nothing to compel them to do so. They did so. One of the things we did when we stormed the room and we packed the room, standing room only, and I think it was to this great surprise of a lot of folks, we got them to open up testimony to allow us, labor and management, to testify things that normally can't be testified to. One of the problems we've got in the state, you've got the Division of Work Comp. They can, and the Department of Labor, they can talk about benefits, etc., but nothing to do with rates or classifications. You can talk to the Division of Insurance, but only about rates or classifications, nothing to do with benefits. You can talk to the Work Comp Board, but they're kind of a quasi-judiciary group. You can't talk to them about really rates or benefits or classifications or anything. Now you have the National Council of Compensation Insurance, the only rating bureau in the United States for workers' compensation. It is a non-profit, but their one sole and only customer is the insurance industry. Are they always straight? I don't know. Figures lie, liars figure. We all know that. We all know you can cook numbers. I believe that the rate increases we've seen come through are probably justified. Based on my understanding of the system, based on my understanding of the crap and corruption that's going on out there in the work comp field in this state, yes, I'm going to say they probably are justified. I'm going to say that Mr. Koch is probably right, and those rate increases were low. Net effect this year, if you just take the $160 million worth of premium volume times a 14.3% rate increase, we're talking $18 million increase in a state that has lost its economy. Our workers' comp rates are already one of the highest in the nation. Now, you've got a whole bunch of contractors, manufacturers, etc. out of the state of Washington that come into the state all the time. They bring employees up here. They pay them Washington work comp benefits. It's an unlevel playing field. Labor can't employ people in this state because they're competing with out-of-state labor. Management can't stay in business because they're competing against out-of-state competition who have significantly lower workers' compensation rates. Those people from Washington are not required, even though they probably should be, there's nothing there that forces them to buy the Alaska Work Comp, so at least we operate on a level ground. There's something wrong there. They've also got a problem coming around here And I think that it's going to have to be dealt with soon, and that's really digresses, but the problem is going to be one with contractors or anybody who has a fixed price contract that has bid work, that has secured that work using old workers' compensation rates. In the contracting field, the average increase is 20%. There can be swings as high as 46%. That is going to put folks out of business. If there is not something that comes along that allows them to pass through those costs, especially to the state, we're going to have some big problems. One of the things we've done, labor and management got to talking, and we decided it's about time we sit down. We think there's a lot of things we agree on. We are putting back together an old group that was known as the Ad Hoc Commission. The Ad Hoc Commission is a platform for labor management to talk. It fell apart for several reasons in the past. We're hoping we have corrected some of those reasons. We are going to be, through the Commissioner of Labor, asking the Governor to appoint this commission as a Blue Ribbon Task Force, empower this task force with some horsepower so they can go investigate the problem, they can take public testimony hearing, they can do investigative research, and they can negotiate between labor management, the users, and the buyers of the coverage, any statutory changes in law or any administrative changes in regulations. We would like to have the blessing of Juno to do that because we think it's important. And that's the two main players working together. One last word, and then I'll quit. I have also thrown a rock at a real glass house. The rock hasn't got to the house yet. We've got a lot of people scrambling to catch the darn thing. WCCA, Work Comp Committee of Alaska, which is what I'm from, is a management advocate. WCCA is going to have both labor and non-labor management that's going to sit on its executive committee. We have told the medical industry, the rehabilitation industry, the attorneys, the adjusters, the insurance companies, folks, you got until next Tuesday to get in here, get on our board. We think you are probably the best of everybody to tell us what's wrong with the system, help us identify the problems, and show us how to fix it. Now, those of you that show up, you're going to be listened to. Your plans are going to be given a lot of consideration. The executive committee, composed solely of management, is going to pass judgment. Anything that that committee says is good, we're going to send off to the Ad Hoc Commission for their review. Any of these people are able on their own to go separately to the Ad Hoc, but I don't think they're probably going to get far because it's going to look like special interest. We have said, if you want to come join up, you can. If you don't join up, we're going to investigate it for you. We're going to arrive at our own conclusions without you, and that's what we're going to push. Now, that's a pretty big rock. It's sailing at the glass house, and we got folks scrambling. I don't know if we're going to win or lose on that deal, but it has certainly stirred up the pot, and it's about time to start talking about it. This time next year, we're going to be looking at another $20, $30 million increase in premiums. State insurance comp rates for state employees went up 36%. That's a big hunk when you're trying to cut the budget. Something's wrong. We need to identify it. Please help us to do that. I'm done. I'll take questions.
Thanks, Frank. Is there any questions? Max?
You mentioned that there's the second injury fund.
Oh, thank you.
That there's a second injury fund with several million dollars. Is that in the state treasury, or where is that?
I believe that sits in the general fund. It's managed by the Commissioner of Labor. It's employer money that goes into it. The monies that actually go into that fund can only be used to pay second injury claims. State general fund pays the operating expense, as I understand.
Is that available?
Available for the state?
Yes.
No, sir. I wrote a rather scathing letter when I heard that it was being looked at for that, and I said, absolutely not. That's employer's money. No.
Essentially, one of the things you're saying is that contractors who come into the state from outside are not adhering to the workers' comp benefits. In other words, they are violating Alaskan statutes by not offering the workers who are working in Alaska, who may be injured in Alaska, the benefits that are prescribed by Alaska law.
That is correct, sir.
Thank you.
I would note that if the person is injured in Alaska and decides to live outside of Alaska in Washington or Oregon, they can collect Alaska workman's comp benefits at the Alaska rate.
Yes.
We don't have to deduct them for, don't get to deduct them for cost of living. Okay. I appreciate your testimony, Frank. And since
easy,
I didn't,
Cliff. Hang on.
We'll get Cliff a seatbelt here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're going to switch a little bit here and go from workman's comp into marine insurance. And we have, is Mike Miller here?
That's a tradition for people from Tokyo.
I know there's a need for people, but I don't care.
Get a
week everywhere.
Oh, Slash? Okay, why don't you go ahead?
I think I probably run in contact with most of y'all through a teleconference network, and lo and behold, I'm also an insurance agent. I was invited to come and speak to you on the insurer's perspective, meaning the underwriter, and Bill Hall was invited to come and speak to you on the perspective of the insured. Now, you've ended up with an insurance agent and a banker speaking on things that an underwriter and an insured should be here speaking to you about. So let me just make that clear. I represent Northern Marine Insurance, and we are an insurance brokerage office. The only one in the state of Alaska that deals exclusively with marine insurance. We don't do any homeowners, any business insurance. We don't do auto, none of that. Because of that, we have the capability of monitoring the insurance market for marine risk very closely. We're in constant contact with the underwriters in Alaska who provide marine insurance and the underwriters in Seattle, Washington, and elsewhere in the lower 48. Provide marine insurance in this state. Yes?
I just had a question.
Representative Taylor.
If it's marine insurance, why are we talking about workman's comp? Because marine is underneath the Federal Harbor Workers' Longshore, isn't it?
I think, Mr. Chairman, that we switched gears here.
We switched from workman's comp.
And you're the boat pulling.
You've got to be quicker out here. We spent an hour on workman's comp, now we're going to spend 15 minutes on marine insurance and about 15 minutes on aviation. Thank you, Les. Go ahead.
Sure. Basically, what has occurred over the past year has been what some have called a marketing phenomenon or a marketing disaster. Insurance rates have gone down, or interest rates have gone down. Insurance companies have not made the money that they had planned to make, la-di-da, la-di-da. What has happened in the marine insurance business is that we've seen a very tightened market. The market is hardened, is how we term it, I guess. What that means is that the insurance rates have either become very high for people who are good risk and unattainable for people who are poor risk. Now, who makes those decisions? It's not the insured, and it's not the broker. It's the underwriters. And how are those decisions made? We don't know. We don't have any idea. People say it's tort reform. People say it's this. People say it's that. It's a combination of many, many, many things. And where we are right now, things are getting better. Hull and machinery rates have leveled off. They're starting to come back down. We're starting to see some competition. Whereas when the market was getting hard, you were getting constant negative proclamations from the insurance underwriters. They were saying, we won't do this, absolutely not, we can't handle this. Now that the market's softening, they don't tell you anything. You just keep pushing them, and it gradually softens. It's a good sign for everybody concerned. A year ago, we could not insure, or it was nearly impossible to get older wooden boats over the age of 10 years of age insured. Southeastern boats, the old Saners, the old halibut schooners, beautiful boats, great fishing boats, been here for half a century. Those are great risk. Couldn't get insurance. Now things are starting to loosen back up. P&I insurance, liability. It's not really a state's concern. All P&I cases, Representative Taylor said, are under federal jurisdiction. What has happened in the realm of P&I? Is that things have tightened up.
Just to remind you, on a teleconference, you have to speak a little closer to the mic than into the mic.
Touche. On P&I coverage, things have gotten somewhat better, although we've also seen some movement toward some bad occurrences. Some of the good all-American grade A15 is the best ratings come out on the American insurance companies they're starting to raise their rates just a little bit for the P&I coverage. Particular things, I guess the best way to put it is that insurance dollars from American underwriters from Alaska make up a very small percentage of insurance dollars of America. Marine insurance dollars makes up the very top skim of that money. They get very little in the overall picture. When the insurance industry begins to hurt, we're one of the first things to hurt the most. Now, last year there was a bill passed for the availability of insurance pools for marine risk. What we have decided to call those, instead of pools, we've decided to call them in our office puddles, because that's what they need to be. We do not need a tremendous risk retention pool for marine boats that would go, that would fly in the face of what they're there for. What we do need is we need, just as you were speaking earlier about the risk down in Southeast for the logging, we need very small, exclusive, picky groups of people governing their own safety records, governing that their brother-in-law, who's got the worst boat in the harbor, doesn't get into the pool because his wife's on his back about it, governing all these, you know, making sure that this thing stays pure and simple. The other problem, I shouldn't say problem with pools, because the whole idea of the puddles is great. You're going to run into some regional problems. Some risks are going to make better puddle recipients than other risks. The big, expensive boat that seines, long lines, crabs, does all those things, is going to be real happy to be in a pool. And he's the person that should belong in a pool, because he's the guy who's going to be paying tremendous amounts of premium. The Bristol Bay fisherman, who's got a very limited exposure in a very limited area, his hull and machinery rates and his P&I rates are probably the most competitive in the state. The pools and puddles there aren't going to be as effective, because those pools and puddles are going to have to compete with the normal underwriters. I talk to underwriters every day. We love the Bristol Bay area because it's such a short season. Weather patterns are predictable. They've had low loss ratios there, whereas the seiners who jump from point A to point B to point C to make some extra money with the halibut and whatever, you know, their loss ratios are up a little bit, and that's the difference. That's about all I have really to say, if you have any particular questions.
Needle, you got a question?
Yes, Representative Furness and I were on the Labor and Commerce some years ago when the Royal Bahamas Fair offed up, which was non-existent reinsurer. What was the impact of that, and the long-term, short and long-term impact of such companies coming into the market?
I'm sorry, which companies are those?
Well, Royal Bahamas was a company that sold hull insurance and P&I in Alaska, and you could send your check to this mail drop in the Bahamas, but any request for payment bounded back to people like yourself who happen to have sold a policy.
I personally have never heard of that company. I don't know. I know before I started working at Northern Marine that there were some problems with brokers. As far as that particular instance goes, I have no knowledge of that at all. We try to keep our book of business as clean as possible. We try to keep all of our companies are American companies. And we do have a little access to London, but we don't really like using it because they don't deal in a rational way lots of the time. Some of the time they do, some of the time they don't. And it's just too unpredictable.
Are there any other questions at large? I've got Bill Hall here to talk about some of the problems, I guess, the financing industry faces with insurance. Okay. You're going to stay with us for a minute here. Bill? Bill's rather multi-talented. He's a fisherman also, I think.
Are they there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to correct the previous speaker. I'm not here representing my new employer, which is the Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank. I am here, I think, because as a senior advisor of the Center Advisory Council over the last 3 years, I did prepare a report on the availability and cost of marine insurance in Alaska as it related to the fishing industry. I've also been a 20-year salmon fisherman myself, and currently attempt to make some money in that capacity. I'll just briefly review what the study we put together last year indicated. I would say that anybody who said he could speak for the Alaska fishing industry would be making a misstatement. It's so diverse an industry that I'm not going to presume that ability, but I will review for you a little bit what our study did last year. We analyzed the reasons for the increasing costs in marine insurance as they related to the fishing industry and the availability of marine insurance. And in fact, we had found that insurance was declining in availability and was increasing in cost. What were the reasons for this? There were basically two reasons that we could identify. Major reason that I think has really not received adequate attention is the poor safety record of the industry. This is something that was not possible for the state of Alaska to address in total, although there may be some opportunities there, but because the fishing industry is covered under maritime law and under federal jurisdiction, that problem has to be dealt with on a different level. The second reason we saw a problem was because of the economics of the insurance industry and the loss of financial capacity in the insurance industry. And as the previous speaker said, because marine insurance, particularly fish boat insurance, represents such a small volume of business to most insurers, when they lose capacity, that's the first thing that they get out of. I believe that in the previous year or so, that where we once had 30 or 40 underwriters insuring fishing vessels, that dropped down to 5 or 6 at one time available to the Alaska market. John George indicated to me that he might be up to 6 or 8 right now of underwriters available. There isn't much that we could identify that we could do with the insurance industry. And again, we were limited in what we could do in regard to improving the safety record of the fishing industry. So the option, the recommendation of the study that we did last year was one possibility was to authorize the insurance, the fishing industry to engage in insurance pools. The advantages anticipated for the pools was that being a self-insurance program, they would be self-policing. They would be highly selective. They would also provide the ability to differentiate good risks from the mass of people out there who appear to be bad risks, one gear group from another, one area from another. And they were also viewed as a mechanism, potential mechanism for changing human behavior. At this point, it's my understanding that there are a number of pools in the formative stage. I think only one has so far applied to the Division of Insurance. But in any case, as a long-term solution, I think the pools offer an opportunity for changes in human behavior that can improve the safety record and provide an element of self-policing. I understand that there has been an improvement, as the previous speaker indicated, in the availability of insurance. There are a few more underwriters coming back in. An experimental program last year that was put in for vessels that had previously been uninsurable, the wooden vessels, gas-powered vessels, was successful. The experience, I understand, of the industry in total in marine insurance in Alaska last year was a good experience. They made money on it, so a few more of them are coming back into the business. In regard to hull and machinery insurance, the rates really aren't coming down perceptibly, but they do seem to be stabilizing still at a level which many fishermen find difficult to meet. In regard to P&I insurance, I'd just like to comment that last year there was legislation in the U.S. Congress that dealt with the issue of P&I insurance, which is liability insurance in maritime law. That legislation failed to a great extent because of opposition by trial lawyers regarding a limitation on liability. The bill that was introduced last year became a bill that was contained two parts. It did contain a section on safety that would have mandated increased safety requirements. Much of the support for that section of the bill was motivated by, I think, a gentleman who was a State Department diplomat whose son had died in a fishing vessel sinking out of Kodiak. That effort continues, and if any new legislation is going to go anywhere this year, according to Rod Moore of Congressman Young's office, that the issue between limitation on liability and increased safety requirements is going to be an issue that will have to be resolved. You're not going to get one without the other, I understand. Right now, there is a national conference on fishing vessel insurance and safety taking place in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the Sea Grant Program. There are some people there from Alaska, although it's unfortunate that there's nobody who speaks for the state government or for the fishing industry there right now specifically dealing with it. There was an attempt earlier by the National Conference or Council on Fishing Vessel Safety and Insurance to develop a consensus legislation that might have allowed in which the fishing industry around the nation could have agreed on what was the best approach on dealing with P&I problems, liability insurance issues on fishing vessels. So apparently no agreement has yet been reached. There's an attempt to do that. there'll be an attempt to try to satisfy the concerns of the trial lawyers. Whether or not that's successful, I can't say at this point. So, again, the P&I issue is one that I think will have to be solved on the federal level. I think I've covered about everything I wanted to mention. Any questions? Okay.
Yeah, a lot of questions in terms of in the bank issue or in the state loan issue. What happened last year when people with wooden boats couldn't get insurance that were those boats were financed either through the state or through CFAB or other banks? What did you guys do?
Well, I just joined CFAB in September of this year, so I really can't say exactly what CFAB did. I'm not aware that they took action to foreclose on any vessels because of lack of insurance. I know of one individual last year in which CFAB released the vessel as collateral and took the entry permit instead, and thereby the fellow was able to fish his boat uninsured. It was an older wooden boat for which he just couldn't get insurance. I understand the state loan program last year had at one point discussed initiating foreclosure proceedings on some fishermen who couldn't get insurance. I talked to one individual who said he was going to be foreclosed on. I'm not sure if that happened. I can't speak for them. But that indicates to you the magnitude of that problem. Again, John George tells me that there's another underwriter interested in coming in maybe and dealing with this, with a problem with that category of vessels. So maybe that problem is going to be so acute.
Yeah, I guess I just relay my experience of two or three fishermen I know in Ketchikan that have transferred the loans on their boats, I guess, over to their houses and taken out secondary loans on houses and property, paid the boat off so then they can drive the boat without insurance. Just because they can't get it.
That only partly solves their problem because they still have to get P&I insurance if they want to cover their crew, if they want to protect themselves against that and protect their crew, and that's not always available if you don't have your vessel insured through with hull machinery. Although it is attainable, I understand.
Yeah. Representative Taylor.
I commend him on following up on that because the people we're talking about here, John, a lot of them ran into the problem where they were going bare on their hull. They went out to buy liability, and nobody in the market would sell them liability without demanding that they also buy hull. So it was a catch-22 thing again. Well, last year, we were doing your study. We had testimony before this committee that the entire scenario of dramatic rate increases was an orchestrated effort on the part of the industry. And at that time, the testimony we were given that within 18 months, and definitely within 2 years, we would see similar dramatic downturn in those rates. Is this softening that we've heard testimony about the rest, but is that the downturn?
Well, I can't speak to the testimony that was given last year regarding that, whether it was orchestrated or not. I'm not that knowledgeable about the insurance industry. It's my understanding that rates have softened, but really aren't really going back down. And again, I would defer to John George or Lasher in regard to that. I know you're still paying the same rates we were paying last year, by and large. P&I rates seem to be going up. It's more difficult to get the liability insurance now. And this, again, is partly because, I think, of increasing claims and maybe just more visibility about the problem.
Okay. Representative Cotton.
Is that report you did for the council, is that available?
Sure. I have one copy here I can leave, and you can request them for additional copies. I think we have a little bit of them.
Representative Cotton's not getting into the fishing business. He's indicated interest here.
Woke up.
Just bought a boat and a permit, so he's on board. Okay, moving from land to water, the next area is the airplane.
Thank you.
See how many parachutists we have here, but Reed Stoops is with us. We have about 15 minutes here, Reed.
Okay, I'm going to use that.
Okay. How's the aviation business doing?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Reed Stoops, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Air Carriers Association. I'm not here as an expert witness, but not in the insurance business, I was able to do a telephone survey of both the insurers and the insured to find out where we are this year as compared with last year, and we provided testimony that rates were increased fairly dramatically and were causing serious problems for the industry. Just by way of quick background for the committee members who weren't involved last year, there's about $30 million worth of hull and liability insurance written in the state for what used to be about 220 air carriers. We're now down to about 190 air carriers because a number of almost 30 have gone bankrupt or gone out of business during this last year, both because of problems relating to insurance, others because of this general downturn in the state's economy. There's primarily two underwriters in the state. Lloyd's of London is the largest and insures the greatest number of carriers. USAID, American Company, is second. And from time to time, there's others who come in and out of the market, but on an intermittent basis. Part of the problem is that it's a specialty line of insurance, and that in order to be successful at it, you need to know quite a bit about the uniqueness of the aviation market, and also about Alaska, because aviation here presents some problems which aren't obvious to people who are involved in aviation insurance in other parts of the country. Last year, or up until about 1985, insurance represented about 8 to 13% of the total cost of doing business in the state. And then we began to see that rise to somewhere between 13 and 20% of the cost of doing business as insurance increased in 1985 and 1986. 1987 looks like rates are going to flatten out pretty much based on what I heard from Lloyd's and USAID. When policies come due this year, they should be at approximately the same rate as last year, although there'll be some variation based on safety records. Where carriers, we're basically talking about carriers who've had good records, they'll probably see the same level of insurance this year as last year. Where there's been significant losses, there's definitely the potential for some increases in 87. When I asked the insurers what they felt would be the what was the impact of the legislation that was passed last year, they said there was some impact. It's one of the reasons why rates flattened out, but it wasn't because of the way the legislation was structured. It wasn't really a significant factor in this year's rates, because a number of the things that were recommended last year were not incorporated into the legislation. When asked what their priorities were in terms of what could be done in order to try to increase both the availability and the affordability of insurance, Civil War 82 came up as the number one area of concern, and the overall liability limit, which you established at $500,000 last year, was also up there. Other than that, the other items that were considered last year were lesser importance.
Great. Thanks, Rajay. Yeah, I'd just testify my understanding on cost of insurance. The air taxi, I was familiar with those, about 20% of gross went into insurance costs last year. So.
Right. And those costs are all costs that are either passed on to the consumer or result in bankruptcies when competition is so severe that it can't be passed on.
Yeah. Max?
I'd ask either one of you gentlemen, if 20% is the cost of insurance, what would the profit margin be on a typical small air carrier?
None right now.
I'm assuming prior to that large insurance. Would it have been less than 20%?
The profit margin?
Right.
Oh yeah, the air carriers traditionally operate on a very small profit. Large gross and very small profit.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's several things. One, I was affiliated with sold out. Just, it depends on what area of the state you're from and how much competition there is. If it's a non-competition area, you get the seat fares and the rates up, you can pay those costs and make money. And if it gets into a high competitive environment, usually it stays competitive till one or two of the entities goes bankrupt, and they can get the rates back up a little bit. But insurance is a major issue, and it brings up the same problem as in the boat insurance, that you can't get liability unless you have hull. And the hull insurance on airplanes is virtually gold plating. I mean, it's very, very expensive. So I'm just interested, Reid, in terms of the availability is bouncing back and forth. So those who can afford it can buy it. It is out
there. Yeah, availability is not as much of a problem now as it was. It's more an issue of affordability. And companies like USAID and Lloyd's tend to prefer to carry the high-quality carriers who have the best maintenance programs and the best safety records. But even carriers that are new to the business are still able who's generally able to acquire the insurance, it's just at an extremely high price.
Well, the aviation industry was putting in a safety program. There was an attempt, I recall, to get all of the carriers together to institute some area-wide safety program. Has that been done?
Yes, that's been in progress, and there was a substantial reduction in the number of accidents in 86 from 85. I wish I could attribute that entirely to the safety program. I think it may have maybe some coincidence involved, but the Aviation Safety Foundation has put together a training program which has been in operation for about a year now. It's available to all the carriers, and I'm sure that that'll have some beneficial impact on safety, which should help to lower the cost of insurance, but there needs to be a whole lot more done in that area because of the often dangerous flying conditions in Alaska.
Representative Taylor?
Yeah, Heavier Air Carriers Association looked into pooling, wasn't it?
They've looked at pooling as a concept, but haven't taken the plunge as yet, because it's sort of like the fishing industry. The organizational problems are difficult given the way the business is structured in the state, and there's also a lot of differences between them. The major carriers like Mark Air or Alaska Airlines wouldn't benefit from it much, but the medium-sized carriers would. But there's somewhat of a reluctance to get in and really police each other, which you need to do in order to make sure that the people in the pool are all relatively equal risks. That's just like the fishermen, they tend to be real independent stores and don't like to pry into each other's business.
Okay, any other questions for Reed?
I just have one.
Representative Taylor?
Reed may not know this, but was there a dramatic increase in actual losses for your industry over the last 5 years that in any way correlates with the dramatic increase in premiums that you've had to pay over the last 2 or 3 years?
It's difficult to answer because we've had a lot of good years and bad years. 82 was a relatively safe year. 83 was a bad year in terms of accidents. 84 was fairly safe. 85 was bad. 86 was good. So there's it's sort of like the stock market, a lot of ups and downs, and there's a delayed reaction.
Don't fly this year.
It sounds like a bad year coming up. Well, I guess what I was getting at, though, is in my experience up here for the last 26 years, that seems to be a normal pattern. We had a good year, bad year, or whatever. Then we go two good and then one bad, and hopefully two more good and one bad. But over time, those things should kind of average out, and your rates certainly have. You've never seen this dramatic of a fluctuation before in your rates. And your rates to me would indicate that you've had a 747 crash once a year, basically. I can't imagine that they've gone up that, your experience rate has gone up that bad.
We'd have to do some more work to confirm that, but I'm relatively sure that would be the case. The big spike in rates was in 85, and based on the safety record, if there was going to be a spike, it was a good reason for it based on safety for that to have happened a lot earlier.
Okay, thank you, Reed. We're just about over. I appreciate and want to thank both committees for staying through this for 3 days. We're going to ask the staff to put together a list of the recommendations or issues that have come out of this hearing, of the issues that may not be problems versus some that are problems, that we've had suggestions for legislation, and Chairman Donnelly and I were just talking that there are some issues here that Labor and Commerce are going to take up in some legislative form on the workman's comp issues, and I'm sure us in Judiciary will see them as they come back. So we'll try to get a summary report out next week so we can distribute it to all the other legislators, tell them what we did and what we found and where we're at. So, and all of you in the audience, thanks for bearing with us. Everybody here has one favorite piece of insurance they like, and sometimes you have to sit through the other guys' boring stuff to get to it.
Chairman,
meeting's adjourned.